is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A look at our top stories this hour. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi hits back at his U.S. counterpart for, quote, inciting chaos, terror, and destruction in another country. Several explosions hit a central area in the Ukraine's capital, Kiev, amid reports of intense fighting between Russian and Ukrainian forces in Donbas region. Also, Russia's energy giant Gazprom warns it will cut supplies to Europe if a price cap is put on Russian gas exports to the continent. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. The Iranian president has denounced his U.S. counterpart for inciting chaos, terror, and destruction in Iran by voicing support for riots.
The U.S. president allows himself to make comments on Iran riots. He has made such comments two or three times in the last couple of days. It's a regret that those who claim to be supporters of human rights, security, peace, and stability support riot, terror, and chaos in Iran.
Ebrahim Raisi's comment came shortly after Biden called the Iranian government oppressive for what he called a crackdown on popular protests. The U.S. president also expressed surprise at, in his own words, the courage of people and women taking to the streets. Raisi now says U.S. officials are angered whenever the Iranian nation takes an innovative and positive step, and they are thrilled to see Iran face difficulties or unrest. The president says the U.S. has played a role in many riots, acts of sabotage, and terror in the region. He cited the U.S.'s 20-year occupation of Afghanistan or its support for Israel's atrocities. Raisi says the Iranian nation knows its enemies and will prevent them from reaching their goals. Tim Anderson is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. He tells us how various U.S. administrations have done all they could to weaken Iran.
I think it's very well known by now that Washington, whatever the administration is there, whether it's Obama or Trump or Biden, is going to use all of the resources at their disposal to try and weaken, divide, undermine Iran. And every new opportunity will be seized on, basically, because, of course, we know their style of warfare these days is a lot more to do with using proxies, the proxies like the MEK, like the proxies that are in the northern Iraq, like the proxies that are used against Syria, for example, and a constant stream of propaganda to weaken or to confuse their own audiences, principally, basically. I don't think that's really confusing the Iranians, though. It's a long-standing practice of the U.S., and it's emerged in public, and they're not even embarrassed to say it now. They want to starve people, make them desperate, make them rise up against the government, because they know, as they said about Cuba 60 years ago, they said they knew that the Fidel Castro was very popular. The only way for them to try and overthrow the regime there was to make the people desperate and starve. And similarly, you recall Mike Pompeo a few years ago saying that if the Iranian people wanted to eat, they would have to comply with U.S. demands. So it's a very open, direct assault. Of course, it's illegal. It shouldn't be called sanctions. These coercive measures are illegal measures under international law. But they are specifically designed to make people desperate and try and divide people.
The Iranian judiciary says four more inmates have died due to the blaze at Tehran's Evin prison on Friday. The prisoners were earlier said to be in critical condition. Their deaths take the number of lives lost in the fire incident to eight. The judiciary earlier said dozens of inmates were also injured. The blaze started at the prison's sewing workshop following a brawl involving a group of prisoners. Meanwhile, security guards said they foiled an attempted prison break by some of the inmates convicted of violent and dangerous crimes. The situation has returned to normal at the penitentiary. The British capital, London, has hosted this year's annual Islamic Unity Conference. The event brings together religious leaders of various Muslim sects together under one roof to promote peace and combat division. This year's conference comes amid a global campaign targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran. Robert Carter attended the event and has filed this report.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Walayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
Several explosions have hit central Kiev for the second time in a week, damaging several residential buildings. Local officials say the city was hit four times in the early morning attack. They say one of the targets was Kiev's central train station. The city was hit with several explosions last week when Russia staged a massive missile attack into Ukraine in retaliation for a blast on a bridge linking mainland Russia to Crimea. Separately, officials in Ukraine's eastern region of Dnipropetrovsk say a big fire broke out at an energy facility there after a missile hit it. This comes as Russian and Ukrainian forces are engaged in heavy fighting around Donetsk and Luhansk in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. Our correspondent Johnny Miller is with us from Donetsk. Johnny, it's good to talk to you. Tell us more about the explosions in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev.
In Kiev today, we're woken up by the sound of Russian bombing of the capital. It's not clear all the targets yet. You mentioned the train station. It's also looks like it's been confirmed that the headquarters of the main Ukrainian energy company has also been hit. This is in line with Russia's new policy to start hitting civil infrastructure and particularly power stations, energy infrastructure. This, of course, helps to inhibit Ukraine's ability on the battlefield, but also will make life more difficult for civilians. So, as you mentioned, Russia has been hitting Kiev and other cities increasingly over the last week, and that looks like it'll set to continue. Meanwhile, here in Donetsk, as almost every day in this war so far, constant explosions heard in this city as Ukraine bombs Donetsk, mainly anti-air defense working in the skies behind me. Many foreign countries are calling for their citizens to leave Kiev as the expectation of this bombing will continue.
Johnny, the attack last week on Kiev was seen as a retaliatory attack on the part of Russia, a retaliation for the attack on the Crimea Bridge. Should this attack, too, be seen as a retaliatory attack?
Well, there is a lot of tit-for-tat attacks going on at the moment. Yesterday, I reported in Donetsk, the central city administration was hit with American HIMAR missiles. That's pretty much the first time that Ukraine has attacked or blown up a decision-making center here in Donetsk. And that was seen as a retaliation for recent Russian strikes. So there is an element of retaliatory strikes from both sides here. But also, it's part of a wider campaign from Russia. They've just mobilized 300,000 troops. NATO continues to support Ukraine, calling for Ukraine to continue fighting. So in terms of retaliation, on a wider scale, it's also Russian retaliating for NATO's continued support as well. They've just put in place a General Sorovkin, the Russians, of their what they call the Special Military Operation. He is famous for leading Russia's fights against ISIS, very successful fights against ISIS in Syria. And he's known as a more of a hardline military strategist, not worried about bombing cities. So it's also part of a wider campaign for Russia to step up. It calls it special military operation. There's also reports of a lot of troops mobilizing on the Belarusian borders, and there's an expectation that Russia may well escalate further in the coming days or weeks.
And finally, Johnny, there is some report of a big fire breaking out at an energy facility in Dnipropetrovsk. Do you have any more information on that?
Well, that's part of this major Russian campaign at the moment. Many Western analysts were surprised that Russia, at the beginning of this war, didn't start to hit civil infrastructure there. And that's the kind of thing that the United States has done in Afghanistan and Iraq. So many people are confused as why Russia didn't hit these targets six months ago. But now Russia was concerned with hitting military targets, but now it's changing its policy to start hitting energy supplies in order to damage infrastructure and make it harder for Ukraine on the battlefield.
Many thanks, Johnny. Stay safe, please. That's Johnny Miller, our correspondent in Donetsk. Moving on, Russia's energy giant Gazprom warns of tit-for-tat action against any potential move by the European Union to impose a price cap on Russian gas. The head of Gazprom said gas deliveries to Europe would be halted in case the bloc goes ahead with price capping. Alexei Miller described the plan as a unilateral decision, saying Gazprom complies with terms and conditions of the existing contracts. He added imposing a price cap on Russian gas by the EU will be a breach of those contracts. The energy ministers of 15 EU states have sent a joint appeal to the European Commission demanding a price cap for gas imports to the bloc. They argued that the decision would be in line with effort to fight soaring energy prices in Europe. Clashes have erupted between French police and angry demonstrators who rallied in the capital Paris to protest against soaring living costs and climate inaction. Police used tear gas and pepper spray to disperse the protesters who in turn threw objects at security forces. The protesters were also pushing against proposed pension reforms. The demonstration was called by left-wing political parties backed by hundreds of associations. France has already been hit by weeks of refinery strikes that have caused fuel shortages across the country. The workers demand wage hikes to cover inflation and include a share of the huge profits made by oil companies. Prime Minister Elizabeth Warren has warned striking oil industry workers that the government might use its requisition powers to force them back to their jobs to ease fuel shortages. Political commentator Jan Stepling explains how the people in France are finding it difficult to get by with the ongoing cost of living crisis.
The cost of living has risen so precipitously. The gas prices are amazingly high, even in Scandinavia here. Food prices have risen far beyond anything that's actually even reported. And again, this is true even in a country like Norway. So people are reaching a point where it's not sustainable for them. And winter, of course, is coming, and the prospect of having to heat your house in the winter months, especially in northern European countries, is causing people a great deal of anxiety. And the governments of Europe have no answer for this. In the EU, Ursula von der Leyen just keeps repeating the same sort of mantra about we have to send weapons and money to Ukraine and so forth. Prices are just unrealistically high. I mean, impossible for people to survive if they stay at this level. Impossible for them to heat their homes in winter if they stay at this level. Just literally impossible.
As the energy crisis continues to bite in Italy, people from all walks of life have been staging protests across the country. From students to workers, Italians are urging the next government to put the community back in the center of political discourse and work for peace. Top EU diplomat Josep Borrell is under increasing fire for a recent analogy he made. In it, he drew what many have described as a racist and offensive contrast between Europe and the rest of the world. The remarks sent social media into a frenzy. Let's take a listen to some of those reactions, but first, this is Borrell himself.
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything works. It's the best combination of political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that the humankind has been able to build. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. The rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it in order to protect the garden. The gardeners have to go to the jungle. The Europeans have to be much more engaged with the rest of the world. Otherwise, the rest of the world will invade us by different ways and means.
Is Africa still a jungle only meant to furnish someone else's garden, as it has painfully been so? You looted the jungle for generations to build your garden, sit down. Years ago, war criminal Prime Minister Ehud Barak described Israel as a village in the jungle. Today, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell describes the EU as a garden in the jungle. These truly are the shared values of these putrid racist colonialists.
This racist's garden only grows because of everything he and those he represents steal from the jungle.
Well, that's a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you for your company. Stay with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Climate emergency is just a rhetoric by Western regimes. This claim is evident by these regimes' disregard for the climate emergency and warnings against fossil fuel exploration. In a new move, the UK has opened up a new licensing round to allow oil and gas companies to explore for fossil fuels in the North Sea despite threats of a legal battle from climate campaigners. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Guardian wrote this headline saying UK offers new North Sea oil and gas licenses despite climate concerns. Guardian said the UK has opened up a new licensing round to allow oil and gas companies to explore for fossil fuels in the North Sea despite threats of a legal battle from climate campaigners. The North Sea Transition Authority has begun a process to award more than 100 licenses to companies hoping to extract oil and gas in the area. Almost 900 locations are being offered up for exploration. The process, which will run until the end of June, is the first since 2019 to 2020. The process was near annual before that, but it was put on hold by the government while it designed a climate compatibility check. However, the check has been criticized because it is only advisory and does not restrict authorities from granting a license. The licensing round also faces criticism as it will not solve Britain's short-term problems around potential gas shortages or sky-high bills. Climate campaigners at Greenpeace said the decision to launch the licensing round was possibly unlawful, and we will be carefully examining opportunities to take action. Since Liz Truss became Prime Minister, she has reopened the door to fracking in the UK and resisted calls from Labour to extend the windfall tax on oil and gas companies. The chief executive of Shell this week said governments may need to tax energy companies to fund efforts to protect the poorest people from soaring bills. The government argues the new licenses will boost Britain's energy security and create jobs, while the climate minister, Graham Stewart, said it would be good for the environment. Actually, it's good for the environment because when we burn our own gas, it's got lower emissions around its production than foreign gas, as well as supporting British jobs, Stewart claimed, speaking to BBC Breakfast. Philip Evans, an energy transition campaigner for Greenpeace UK, said, "Yet again, this government's energy policy benefits fossil fuel companies and no one else, supporting the oil and gas giants, profiteering from the energy and climate crises, ignores the speedy solutions that are best for the economy, for lowering bills and for the climate. Experts have repeatedly made clear that we need warmer, energy-efficient homes and a big push for cheap, homegrown, renewable power." Yesterday, the IMF explained yet again that any delay to decarbonization makes it much more expensive. New oil and gas licenses won't lower energy bills for struggling families this winter or any winter soon, nor provide energy security in the midterm. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said there has to be a transition away from oil and gas and accused the UK government of haphazard planning for energy. Speaking to BBC Breakfast before the SNP party conference in Aberdeen, she said, "In terms of new licences, I have been very clear that within the context of that just transition, we've got to subject any decisions about further exploitation of oil and gas to the most stringent climate checks." She added, "I worry right now that what we are hearing from the UK government is just a continuation of their haphazard planning about energy."
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this programme we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we will discuss how India continues to defy U.S. sanctions to import crude oil from Russia, making clear it won't toe the Western line on the Ukraine war. And we shall also look at the second wave of catastrophe in Pakistan amid the spread of waterborne diseases and food crisis after the devastating floods.
Defying U.S. sanctions and saber-rattling, India has explicitly reiterated that it will continue importing oil from wherever it needs to, including Russia. India's oil minister made these remarks during a recent visit to Washington as the standoff between Russia and the West intensifies over Ukraine. The simmering war, now in its eighth month, has greatly disrupted the global energy market, affecting supply and demand patterns and trading relationships. But India, as an emerging economic giant, has withstood the pressure to snap its time-tested trade ties with Moscow.
Following his meeting with U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm on October 8th in Washington, India's oil minister Hardeep Singh Puri made it emphatically clear that his country will not toe the Western line on the Ukraine war. He said New Delhi has not been told by anyone to stop importing oil from Russia, asserting that it will continue to buy oil from wherever it has to, keeping in view the government's moral duty to provide energy to the people. The remarks came as soaring energy prices amidst the Ukraine war have begun to bite people around the world, hurting households and industries. India, a close ally of Russia, has refused to join the Western coalition in boycotting Russian energy. Instead, the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi has ramped up crude oil imports from Russia since the Kremlin launched its military operation in Ukraine in February. On the OPEC Plus consortium's decision to slash oil production by 2 million barrels per day, India's oil minister said there are countries in the consortium that have always sold oil to India. He also pointed to hitherto unheard-of sources that New Delhi is looking to import oil from, highlighting the rising demand in India driven by an increase in per capita consumption of energy.
While the boycott of Russian oil and gas amid the Ukraine war has fueled a major energy crisis in Europe, India remains afloat by not only continuing to buy Russian energy, but also scaling up the discounted purchases. It has offset most of the drop in Russian shipments to Europe and managed to neutralize the impact of Western sanctions. Now, India's import of Russian oil in September saw a sizable jump of 18.5% from August, making it again the country's second largest crude supplier after Saudi Arabia.
An analysis by the Financial Times of Chinese and Indian customs data shows the two countries imported 11 million tons more oil from Russia in the second quarter of 2022 compared with the first quarter. Payments for Russian oil from the two countries also increased by $9 billion. The major portion belonged to India, where Russian oil imports surged from 0.66 million in the first quarter to 8.42 million in the second. As per energy cargo tracker Vortexa, the purchase of 879,000 barrels per day of Russian oil in September was the second highest in a month ever for India after 933,000 in June. Russia's gain has been America's loss. The U.S. now has only about 4% of the Indian market, down from 10% the previous year. The purchase of Russia's refined products has also spiked, with fuel oil imports reaching 10,000 barrels per day in September, up from an average of nearly 60,000 BPD in the first quarter of 2022. Discounted crude is critical for India as it meets 83% of demand through imports. Recently, India's finance minister Nirmala Sitharaman stressed that importing oil from Russia was part of the government's inflation management strategy, which shows national interest matters to New Delhi more than anything else.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Nainan, the editor-in-chief of a PetroWatch, a fortnightly oil and gas newsletter, now in its 25th year of publication. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Nainan. Now, India's oil minister made a categorical statement during his recent visit to the U.S. that the country will buy oil from wherever it has to. So what message does this send across?
Yes, India's oil minister Hardeep Puri has been quoted saying that India will buy crude oil from wherever it has to. This has been the policy of the government of India for years, decades, and rightly so, because India today imports about 85 or 86% of its crude oil requirement. For such a big dependence, I mean, for a country which depends on imports for such a large portion, predominant portion of its requirement, what is the choice? There's no choice. India has to buy crude oil at the best prices that it can get globally. And typically, this has been the policy and the practice for decades. Typically, India signs two kinds of contracts. There are the term contracts as well as spot buying. Term contracts are usually with state-owned oil companies in producing countries. And spot is could be with state-owned as well as with private oil companies, depending on requirements of the market in India, requirements of petrol and diesel in the market in India. So, Mr. Puri was just restating the government's well-known position that the country will buy crude oil from wherever it can at the best possible prices, because it has a duty to the consumers, to the citizens of this country, to provide petrol and diesel at the best possible prices.
Now, Mr. Nainan, Russia bounced back to become India's second largest crude oil supply in September, while the war in Ukraine continues to simmer. Now, does this show the waning American influence in the new world order?
Yes, Russia was in September the second largest source of crude oil for India. I believe it is just a question of the price at which India was able to secure the source of crude oil. If you remember, before September, for a couple of months, it was Iraq who was number two, the second biggest source of crude oil for the Indian refiners, simply because it offered a better price. And tomorrow, if somebody else, some other country, offers a better price, I'm sure that country will become number two or even number one. As of today, number one is Saudi Arabia. But it is all, to me, just a question of where India, the Indian refiners, can get the best possible price. There's nothing else involved here. There is no politics, nothing. It's pure and simple what the price at which India can import the crude oil so that its consumers get petrol and diesel and LPG, cooking gas, at the best possible prices. That's it. There's nothing more to be read into this. It doesn't indicate the waning of American influence in the new world order or any such thing. If tomorrow American exporters are offering good discounts, I'm sure India will buy, and why not from them? Definitely they should buy.
Mr. Nainan, Indian officials have downplayed any significant impact of the OPEC's decision to slash oil production by 2 million barrels per day on the country. Now, what's your take on this?
Yes, Indian officials have said that the OPEC cut, production cut of 2 million barrels per day, will have no significant impact on India. I don't think so. Cut in production by OPEC will lead to an increase in prices, crude oil prices, because demand, especially in the big consuming countries like China and India, continues to be strong. And when demand is strong and availability of crude oil is less, it's natural and it's logical for prices to go up. And you must remember that this OPEC cut is coupled with the EU's decision to impose a price cap on Russian crude oil. Add these two, and then if Russia says, okay, we are not willing to sell crude oil at this price, I mean, it's going to be a huge impact, not just on India, but on all crude oil importing countries globally. And prices, according to me, will go up. I'm not sure how much it could go up or how, you know, what level it could see. But then, yes, there will be an impact. How can anyone say that there will not be an impact? I mean, India imports 85-86% of its crude oil requirement. And any production cut leads to a price increase unless demand is down elsewhere globally. I mean, at least in India, the demand is not down. So why should there be, obviously there will be an impact.
There you have it, Mr. Nainan. Thank you for being on the program. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Singapore-based writer Smita Barua argues that West has failed to control Russia through sanctions and is facing heat now due to soaring energy prices, adding that the New York Times falsely portrays India as a lucky beneficiary of it. S.L. Canton, Indian writer on geopolitics and economics, says India and China are each importing 1 million barrels of Russian oil every day, replacing Europe as Russia's largest customers. New Delhi-based journalist Sidhant Sibal quotes Indian Oil Minister Hardeep Puri as saying during his recent official visit to the U.S. that New Delhi will buy oil from wherever it has to.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Four months after torrential rains triggered the most devastating flooding in Pakistan's recent history, a wave of waterborne diseases is spreading across the country, putting millions of lives at risk. The World Health Organization has already raised the alarm about a second disaster in the South Asian country. Millions of people are now forced to consume contaminated water, resulting in increased exposure to waterborne diseases, including acute water diarrhea, malaria, dengue fever, and typhoid measles, with little help coming their way.
The United Nations has warned of a second wave of catastrophe in Pakistan amid a rising number of deaths from waterborne diseases. Nearly 1,700 people died in the disastrous floods caused by torrential rains. More than 340 people have died so far of diseases caused by the floods. The health crisis has only exacerbated the country's protracted economic crisis. The worst-hit province of Sindh in southeast Pakistan has reported 17,285 cases of malaria since July 1st, according to provincial authorities. UNICEF, in a statement earlier this week, said almost 10 million children were in need of immediate life-saving support in the country, particularly in Sindh, warning that more children will die if urgent action is not taken. It said more than 500,000 children face severe acute malnutrition and need immediate treatment. With Pakistan bracing for more floods, the fragile healthcare system is likely to be tested more amid economic woes. What makes matters worse is that only about 1% of the country's total GDP is pumped into the healthcare sector, while international assistance also remains limited. The floods have reportedly damaged around 1,500 health facilities in areas worst hit by floods, and makeshift facilities are ill-equipped for emergency response efforts.
The international funding appeal launched jointly by the UN and the Pakistani government is seeking $815 million, a five-fold increase from the appeal issued in August to battle what is emerging as a major public health and food emergency. The crisis has affected large swathes of the country of 220 million people. Nearly 1,700 people have died, almost 8 million people have been displaced, and millions of children are in need of assistance, with Prime Minister Sharif asking for an, quote, infinite amount of funding for relief efforts.
Are still underwater.
Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif recently said his country needs an infinite amount of funding to support flood relief efforts. Now the challenge has been compounded by the health and food crisis amid the spread of waterborne diseases. The fresh appeal for more than $800 million comes as the crisis-stricken country struggles to cope after thousands of hospitals and health centers were damaged or destroyed in recent floods. Pakistan's climate change minister, Sheri Rehman, said last week that more than 20 million people face an entirely precarious future, with 8 million of them requiring urgent medical services. Also, the devastating floods have wiped out nearly 800,000 hectares of farmland in the country, according to authorities, damaging crops deemed critical to Pakistan's food supply chain. The key food items such as rice, wheat, and cotton face the risk of shortages, with southeastern Sindh province being the worst hit. According to economists, it could push double-digit inflation to new highs if significant international help does not reach on time. The International Committee of the Red Cross has warned of a rise in acute hunger, with at least 43% of Pakistan already facing food insecurity before the deluge struck.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Malik, social commentator and researcher in contemporary history. Welcome to the program, Mr. Malik. Now, after the deluge comes another disaster, the spread of waterborne diseases in Pakistan. So, what are the main challenges facing the government in responding to the crisis?
So, the situation, as we all know, is quite dire in Pakistan. But the biggest problem that the government is facing at the moment is the trust deficit challenge. The overseas Pakistanis, 10 million of them, don't actually trust the federal government in Pakistan. And the funding hasn't been flowing as much as it should to the central government. However, funding has been given to a lot of organizations that are working in Pakistan, especially the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, who is a well-known philanthropist around the world. He's managed to collect almost $50 million that is being targeted towards provinces where mostly his party is in power. So that would be Punjab, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and parts of Kashmir and Gilgit-Baltistan. So the other problem is that the government also includes people that are part of this mafia that control the supply of medication and medicines. So the medicine prices have shot up and the government hasn't been able to do anything about it because the people that control the prices and the supply are actually in power in the first place. So the poor people are not only facing the disaster from the floods, the hunger, but also the fact that they're unable to obtain medication because all the medications are being hoarded. There was a raid in Karachi very recently, so simple medication like paracetamol was being stored and hogged, unfortunately, because of which the prices have shot up. And it's the same across the board, and it's the same across most of the other essential medications that are required to basically help people in times of this dire need.
Now, Mr. Malik, the southeastern Sindh province is the worst affected, with millions of people in need of support. So how's the situation there and what measures are being taken to assist the affected people?
Right. So one thing that the audience needs to understand is that Pakistan is a federation. So the federating units have their own local governments, which are very powerful. The southern province of Sindh, unfortunately, should be one of the richest, but is unfortunately one of the poorest. The party, the Pakistan People's Party, that's been running that province for the past 15 years, is extremely corrupt. It's corrupt even by Pakistan standards. So you can imagine how bad it is. So the situation of the people there was quite dire even before the floods. Food shortages, security, kidnappings, etc., etc. People were faced with these problems. Now after the floods, there's almost been a small uprising within that province, in the sense that the MPAs, the local members of parliament, the local administration have been have not been able to go into the people and distribute all the aid that's been coming in, simply because people are very angry with them. And the other unfortunate situation is that the aid is being hogged and in some cases being sold by local authorities. So the judiciary has had to step in, and they've had to open all the storages where the aid is being stored, and where so many people are in need of this aid. It's being not only being hogged, like I said earlier, being sold, and also, and most importantly, the roads have been impacted. Therefore, there's in some areas supplies can only be delivered via helicopters, and there's shortage of helicopters. The Pakistan military and the Pakistan Navy has intervened, and they've done what they can, but unfortunately in the southern province of Sindh, which is a low-lying area, which is where all the water, the ones that drains from the mountainous areas where the rains actually happened, drains down, it tends to stay there for longer. Therefore, the misery of the people of Sindh gets protracted. As we stand at the moment, there's still large parts of the province is underwater. The only people working there are private organizations, philanthropic organizations, and the Pakistan Army and the Navy. The local government structure has collapsed. There wasn't much of it there to begin with, but now they've just literally hidden away, because they know people are so angry with them that if they do go out in public, there is a real danger that, you know, their lives would be at risk.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Malik for being on the program. Now let's see what people had to say on social media.
Asad Razouk, author and climate change expert, says 17% of Pakistan is still flooded, and the country is now battling the second wave of the catastrophe amid waterborne diseases and malnutrition. Johns Hopkins University economist Steve Hank declares that Pakistan is on the brink, with thousands dying daily from waterborne diseases, referring to more than 17,285 cases of malaria and 340 deaths since July 1st. Shabnam Baloch, a scientist and writer, states that the UN has revised its appeal for Pakistan to $816 million from $160 million amid surge of waterborne diseases and fear of growing hunger crisis.
And that was our episode about India ramping up its oil trade with Russia despite US sanctions and saber rattling. And also, Pakistan grappling with an epidemic of diseases after the devastating deluge. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight. The energy crisis in Europe has become the most important topic in the Western media. According to economists, the European economy is severely going into recession, and industry is also under heavy pressure. People in the European Union countries are grappling with a soaring cost of living crisis, and food bank usage is rising at an unprecedented rate. We take a look at some of the world press and news agencies' coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia Today tells us more. More than 60% of people in each of 7 Western European countries examined by YouGov say that their government is doing badly at managing the cost of living. Large majorities have been forced to cut their household spending and expect the trend to continue. The countries analysed in the YouGov survey include Britain, Italy, Germany, Spain, France, Sweden and Denmark. The most widespread dissatisfaction was expressed by British and Italian respondents. About 82% in the two countries assessed their respective government's attempt at cost control negatively, with just 10% and 13% saying leaders were doing well. Also, while 65% and 62% in Sweden and Denmark respectively were unhappy, 27% in both countries said the governments are doing a good job at dealing with the cost of living crisis. The YouGov survey said no fewer than 80% of people in each country have either made cuts or believe that they will have to do so, rising as high as 93% in Italy. Some 41% of the Italian public also state that in the last 3 months they have always or most of the time struggled to afford their energy bills. YouGov noted that incoming Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni will have to act quickly to resolve the matter. Moving to Britain, YouGov's September survey indicates the vast majority of the British public also disapprove of the Cabinet's new economic plans. At the moment, 72% of respondents thought that abolishing the top rate of tax was the wrong priority at the present time. Energy and living costs in Europe have increased